From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we explore the findings of the latest Marquette Law School poll that asks Wisconsinites how they feel about the coronavirus pandemic. We also look into new reporting that has shown spikes in gun violence during the coronavirus pandemic.
Those sorts of interruptions to someone's daily life really do sort of hurt their chances of being away from violence, because we at least know that while you're at work, while you're at school, it's difficult to also be shooting a gun.
Plus, a local distiller talks about the transition into making hand sanitizer to help ease the nationwide shortage.
You know, I anticipated a little bit of a run on hand sanitizer right when this first got announced, but then that, you know, the mass scale producers would catch up right away and that the shelves would be filled again 2 weeks later. And that didn't happen at all.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is still grappling with how to approach school and business closings, soaring unemployment, and a still deadly virus that could overwhelm hospitals. But a majority of Wisconsinites support COVID-19 restrictions, according to the latest Marquette Law School poll that was released yesterday. At the same time, there's been a decline in support for restrictions since the previous Marquette poll, and a partisan split that didn't really exist in March. How Wisconsinites feel about the coronavirus pandemic was the central question in this month's poll, along with finding out how people are doing economically. The poll surveyed more than 800 registered voters in Wisconsin from May 3rd through the 7th. To find out more about what the poll discovered, I'm joined by WUWM's Mayon Silver. Hi, Mayon.
Hi, Audrey.
So the last Marquette poll happened at the end of March, when shutdowns for the coronavirus pandemic were still relatively fresh and new for people. Now that it's 6 weeks later, what was the poll trying to find out?
Yeah, so Audrey, the poll was really asking things that we all want to know. So it was asking, what are the public's attitudes now that the pandemic has dragged on? Do they think safer at home measures are still necessary? You know, talking about the closing of schools and businesses. What about social distancing? Do they feel comfortable leaving their homes, and in what context? How long do people think that the pandemic will last? What do they feel that the government should be doing? So you're getting kind of the point here, and do they approve of the government's approach? The poll also addressed who's being affected economically.
So really running the gamut of all the things that have been basically at the top of our minds during this whole pandemic. But for those of us who haven't maybe been following, you know, a common saying is the days kind of meld together. You know, what's the context that we have right now on safer at home? Where are we since the initial declaration by Governor Evers?
Right. So Democratic Governor Tony Evers' administration, they've extended the safer at home order through most of May, but the Republican-controlled legislature sued in the state Supreme Court to essentially halt that order and give the legislature a say in who starts opening up and when in a relatively short timeline. So this prompted a legal battle, and there's a partisan divide in government. Also, there's been several anti-shutdown protests around the state by conservatives, and Governor Evers has put out a plan to, you know, his own plan as to how to reopen the government. But the whole, you know, kind of conflict is about how to do it, under what circumstances, and when. So that's kind of where things are.
So the shutdown obviously is a big issue in Wisconsin and, of course, across the country, globally. But focusing on our state, what are some of the key takeaways from the Marquette Law School poll?
This poll was conducted from May 3rd to last Thursday, and it found that a strong majority still supports safer at home. So when we're talking numbers, it's nearly 70% who think that closing schools and businesses is an appropriate reaction to this pandemic, and about a quarter think that it's an overreaction. But that's actually down from March. So when we're looking at the previous Marquette poll, it was done about 6 weeks ago. And at that point, more than 85% of people thought safer at home was appropriate. So that's as compared to the 70% now. And back then, just 10% of people said that it was an overreaction. And that's as opposed to about a quarter now. So there is a reduction in the amount of support for the safer at home order. Charles Franklin, who's the director of the Marquette poll, says that there's no question that there's a growing minority who's eager to see us reopen. And that follows along increasingly partisan lines. So back in March, about three quarters of Republicans supported a shutdown. So that's, you know, three out of every four Republicans were in support of it. And now it's about a 50-50 split. Meanwhile, on this partisan divide, more than 90% of Democrats are in favor of the shutdown. Charles Franklin of the poll explained that there was very little partisan gap on the question of whether it was appropriate to shut down or whether it was an overreaction in March. But now that gap has grown and Republicans are leading the way in criticism.
So with this political gap growing, besides this at the state leadership level, was there any other evidence of political polarization from the poll itself?
Yeah, there was a big partisan split on who voters would trust to reopen the government. Overall, a majority says they trust the governor more than the legislature on the issue of reopening and relaxing restrictions on public gatherings. So that's 53% of the people surveyed in Wisconsin think that the governor should be in charge of this. But based on party ID, it turns out that nearly 60% of Republicans and also of those that lean Republican trust the legislature, and about 81 to 82% respectively, just over 80% of Democrats and those who lean Democrat trust the governor to make those decisions. So there's a big partisan split there, and also a little less than a third of those polled support anti-shutdown demonstrations, and just over 60% oppose the demonstrations.
So definitely showing that growing divide. And this is just one aspect in the ways the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our lives. So when it comes to people's sense of normalcy, you know, obviously you and I are doing this from our homes respectively. So when it came to the poll, what do people say they feel comfortable doing and what they don't feel comfortable doing in their everyday lives in this new reality?
This is essentially a grab bag. So 77% of people, so almost 80% of people are comfortable visiting a friend or a family member's home, but only 25%, so a quarter of people, are comfortable attending large sporting events or concerts. Doing things like shopping or going to churches or synagogues or mosques are somewhere in the middle. Charles Franklin, Professor Franklin, said that it seems like this is really depending on how many people we think we'll be exposed to and how kind of jammed together we'll be.
So we've been going through an official shutdown and safer at home orders for quite some time. Did the poll expose any, you know, coronavirus fatigue?
Yes. The poll is showing declines in levels of concern about the coronavirus across all partisan groups. That's Republican, lean Republican, independent, lean Democratic, and Democratic. So the number of voters in all these groups who've said they're very concerned about the coronavirus has gone down since March, but there's still a majority of people who are very or somewhat concerned. And so on the farthest partisan lines, 96% of Democrats are now very or somewhat concerned about the coronavirus, as opposed to back in March, it was 99% of Democrats. And now 67% of Republicans are very or somewhat concerned about the coronavirus. And that's down from 90% in March. So on the polar ends of the partisan spectrum, you'll see that, you know, a majority of people are now very or somewhat concerned about the coronavirus, but it's down since the past.
And on that note, what are people thinking about how long this pandemic will last?
That's interesting, because it seems the longer this is going on, the longer people realize it probably will go on. Back in March, just over 70% of people surveyed thought the virus would be under control and life would be back to normal by August. Now, under 40% feel that way. And in March, 20% said that it would be fall or later that we would be okay and things would be back to normal and the virus would be under control. And now it's 51% of people think that it's going to be fall or later. And Professor Franklin actually addressed that in a conversation yesterday.
So I think you're seeing two things going on. One is people are getting more anxious, and especially with parties pushing them in different directions, we're more divided on this. But the idea that we could be finished with this by May or even August is really evaporating as people are seeing this as a much longer problem.
So now, kind of broadening people's perspectives, what do people think of Governor Evers and President Trump's handling of the coronavirus? So our state versus federal level of what has been happening.
A solid 64% of people surveyed approve of Evers' response, while 32% disapprove. However, it's down from March, when about three quarters of people approved of Evers' handling of the pandemic and just 17% disapproved. When it comes to President Donald Trump's handling of the coronavirus outbreak, that's also declined to 44%. So 44% of people are approving of his handling, and 51% are disapproving in this Marquette poll. In March, his approval was at 51%, and the disapproval was at 46%. So that's sort of flipped almost. And so basically, it's 6 percentage points under 50% are approving of President Trump's handling of the outbreak. When we're talking about overall job approval for these two politicians, Evers is at 59% this month. So that's down from 65% 6 weeks ago. So that's a decline. But Professor Franklin says they are still very solid majorities by all the normal metrics for Governor Evers. And it's considerably higher than where Governor Evers was before the pandemic broke out. When it comes to President Trump's overall job approval via the Marquette poll, it hasn't really budged in the past 5 months. It's 1 point down from where it was in March. And so it's now at 47%. And that's really within the margin of error.
So despite what we're wrapped up in today, we also have to think about November elections. So when it comes to two presidential candidates stacking up against each other, how do they fare in the Marquette Law School poll?
So the poll has Joe Biden as a presumptive Democratic nominee at 46 points and Trump at 43. So that's the same margin back in March, with just a little bit higher numbers for the two of them. At that point, Biden was at 48% support, and President Trump was at 45%. And all of this is still within the margin of error from March to May.
One of the greatest things about this pandemic that has impacted everyone really significantly is, of course, economically. Job loss is the highest it's been, and a record number of people have filed for unemployment. So when it comes to Wisconsinites, how are they saying they've been impacted in this way?
Yeah, the Marquette poll did address this, and you know, there have been huge economic impacts with unemployment claims skyrocketing. The poll basically came out and indicated that 15% of people surveyed had lost a job, but it's been African Americans who have been hit the hardest on this. So 30% of African Americans lost jobs, reportedly, in the Marquette poll. Whites are below average at 11%, and the Latino population is somewhere in between Blacks and whites for the job loss reporting. And here's Professor Franklin elaborating on this a little bit.
Back in January and February, just 10% of Blacks said that their financial situation was just struggling to get by. But this month, it's 25% who say the same among African Americans. So that's the consequence of these job losses.
Franklin says these are the consequences that we'll see disproportionately affecting not only the Black community, but also the city of Milwaukee and the Milwaukee region going forward.
Does Professor Franklin also think these economic struggles will result in a lower turnout in November? Granted, our spring election was a big contentious issue, and we still are trying to figure out the repercussions of that. But when it comes to the presidential election that people usually turn out for in great numbers, how will this impact that?
Franklin says there's some evidence in the academic literature that job losses, for example, often leads to a lowering of voter turnout among the affected groups because they're more preoccupied with their personal predicament and less likely to turn out to vote. Franklin says he doesn't know whether this will be the case in November because we've seen high turnout in the 2018 elections and in the spring election in April 7th. So there's evidence the state as a whole is pretty mobilized and energetic. And also people in dire circumstances could be more motivated to vote for change. So he says we'll have to wait and see how the course of the virus and the economy changes people's views about voting in the fall.
And as we're addressing voting, this Marquette Law School poll also asked people about how they'd like to vote and their attitudes about vote by mail, which, again, is something the April election highlighted.
Yeah, so it turns out over a third of people want the state to transition to entirely vote by mail for the November election, while just under 60% of people say it's important to keep in-person voting as an option as long as people have an alternative. And Wisconsin has a long tradition of being a predominantly vote by mail state. But interestingly, in terms of how people say they want to vote, 54%, so over half, said early absentee or mail vote would be the way that they want to vote. And under 40% said that they would vote in person. So it seems that while people want the option to vote in person, it's not necessarily the option they're going to take themselves.
Well, there's certainly a lot of information in here. So thank you, Mayan, for helping us go through it. And thanks so much for your work and your reporting.
Yep, there's a lot of numbers in there, Audrey. Thank you so much.
Mayan Silver is from the WUWM News team and reported on the latest Marquette Law School poll. You can find more information about it at WUWM.com. Coming up next, new reports are showing a spike in gun violence during the pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Emergency room visits have been cut in half during the coronavirus pandemic, according to the American College of Emergency Physicians. But apart from the virus, emergency rooms are also continuing to treat gunshot victims. The Gun Violence Archive found that there has been an increase in shootings nationwide, and Milwaukee is no exception. Champ Barton is a reporter for The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom focused on gun issues in America. He and a national team of journalists looked at the effects that safer-at-home orders have had on gun violence, including right here in Milwaukee. Champ joined Lake Effect's Julian Haida to discuss his team's findings in an article called When the Shootings Don't Stop.
Well, Champ, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you and The Trace did a study of how the coronavirus has affected gun violence in various American cities. We're in Milwaukee, which is a city that you focused on. What did you end up finding? Just kind of give us the broad strokes of your reporting about the effects of the coronavirus and all these shutdowns on gun violence in America's cities.
The broader trend was basically that while a lot of crime has declined as a result of the coronavirus, we don't know why, but largely probably because people are staying in and more people are home, that shootings have sort of resisted that trend, that shootings have continued to increase or stay on par with what they were like before the coronavirus reached the U.S. That wasn't true of every state. And we didn't do a firm analysis of Milwaukee's data because their data was not presented publicly in the same way as some of the other states we looked at. So the data that we're looking at is mostly from January through mid-April, which was around the time that the story ran. Now in Milwaukee, what we did have was the number of shootings that had occurred. And it does seem to be the case that the number of shootings is outpacing the number of shootings that were experienced in Milwaukee at this time last year, at least for shooting fatalities. It's just difficult to tell because the public data that Milwaukee provides does not allow us to do the same exact analysis we did for the other cities.
In the article, you suggest that some of this has to do with the fact that through safer at home and social distancing guidelines, a lot of intervention programs that stem the tide, or at least they argue stem the tide of gun violence, have gone away. People are sheltering in place. They can't do in-person interventions. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they've gone away. They're still working really hard, if not harder than they have in the past. It's just that so much of their work depends on these face-to-face interventions where they're sitting down with someone and telling them, hey, listen, you know, we've seen the data. We know that you are particularly at risk of being shot or being involved in a shooting in some way. And, you know, when it's a police officer sitting in a room with you, along with an intervention worker who is from the same background, from the same city, and they're both telling you, listen, we care about you. We want you to do well. So please, can you, you know, stay out of this or drop this conflict or, you know, let this beef go. You know, that has a really powerful effect. When you take away that person-to-person interaction and you have to reach out via Facebook, or you have to try to call the family member to get a hold of the person, the work just becomes, and you know, we don't have data to prove this, but this is what a lot of these intervention workers think, is that the work just becomes a little bit less effective, or at the very least harder to do. And so that's sort of what they're facing now. And so, you know, we haven't confirmed that the increase in violence is a result of the decrease in the efficacy of the outreach work.
Then again, a lot of the outreach work is hard to prove in good times. I mean,
exactly.
I've been to events put on by violence prevention groups, and people always seem to want to play the devil's advocate and say, well, how do you know you're really helping? On the other hand, even though you say there isn't that much data, this does seem to provide the anecdotal basis that when people don't follow certain tested methods of violence prevention, because circumstances have changed, violence goes up.
For sure. I mean, it's an interesting sort of, you know, miniature case study, you could say, where one of the things that a lot of these intervention groups have struggled with for a long time is there has not been funding into gun violence research. And so no one, or very few people rather, have really done like robust analysis of this work. And it's also really difficult to do a sort of controlled study because you can't like look at a place, you can't like ask them to stop doing work for a certain amount of time. That would be unethical, just to see if shootings go up. And so you kind of have this, you know, natural imposition of like a control situation where you're limiting the amount of work that can be done, and you can sort of see what happens when the work is not done the same way.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit about the economic implications of the coronavirus pandemic. A lot has been said about how working class people are most affected, the kinds of people who work in the service industry who perhaps have been deemed non-essential. And the argument has been made in the past by people who, again, it's hard to study this, but that gun violence has to do with economics, divestment, etc. Does what you found point in that direction, in that when money stops flowing in a particular area, whether it be because of pre-existing kind of racial biases and segregation or because of a pandemic, gun violence goes up?
Yeah, I don't know if it's safe to say it that clearly, at least for the violence prevention organization. So Forum for Life, you know, still has the funding that it had, that it was granted by the city, and is still sort of, you know, fully staffed in that regard. I think that the question, you know, the broader question that you're pointing to is like, you know, what are the root causes of gun violence, and are they being exacerbated by the coronavirus crisis? And I don't know that we know for sure what the root causes are, but I do think that we know with some certainty that the coronavirus is exacerbating those causes. And so, you know, on specifically related to the economics, I don't know. I know that certainly poverty will exacerbate violence in cities. You know, I know that grief and trauma from deaths as a result of the coronavirus will exacerbate violence in cities, or is at least likely to. And I also know that a lot of the communities where gun violence is most prominent are already low income, and Black, predominantly Black or other minority communities. And those communities typically have the highest proportion of essential workers, because these are people who work government jobs, who are, you know, doing essential sort of, like you were mentioning, like food service jobs or delivery jobs. And so they're also at the highest risk of contracting the coronavirus for that reason. And then in addition, you know, there's been numerous stories about this, but, you know, ProPublica had a really powerful story about Milwaukee as well, that was kind of showing that, you know, gun violence was hitting Milwaukee's Black communities much stronger and harder than it was hitting Milwaukee's white communities. And part of the reason of that was sort of what you're alluding to, this sort of confluence of variables that are a result of, like, you know, decades of systemic racism.
Very interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Champ Barton. He is a reporter covering community violence and the gun industry for The Trace. His recent article, which covers Milwaukee and the effects that the coronavirus has had on gun violence in Milwaukee and several other American cities, is called When the Shootings Don't Stop. Now, Champ, I'm curious a little bit about the shifts that we're talking about, that gun violence has gone up while perhaps other violence has gone down during the coronavirus pandemic in the last few months, has to do in shifts where crime happens and where violence is applied. I've seen boredom invoked for gun violence in some places, kids being out of school, kind of not having your kind of normal routine, leading to violence. How much of that has kind of, have you noticed in the kind of reporting you've done in the last few months?
Like we were just saying, I think that there is a confluence of variables that are both systemic and behavioral. They don't fit neatly into any one sort of category. What you're talking about, though, with you know, quote unquote boredom and having a change in someone's daily routine, I have spoken to researchers who have said that, you know, it's very reasonable to conclude that, you know, not having a job or not getting, having some educational program to be a part of, those sorts of interruptions to someone's daily life, really do sort of hurt their chances of being away from violence, because we at least know that while you're at work, while you're at school, it's difficult to also be shooting a gun. I think the clearest way we can look at that effect, though, would be to look at the people who are already involved in these violence interruption programs. And the researchers that I've spoke with have emphasized to me that it does seem like when you have a person who is in a violence interruption program, so this is a person who has been involved in violence in some way, and someone has reached out to them and tried to intervene in that, in a conflict or in sort of a lifestyle choice, that getting those people involved in jobs, getting those people involved in school programs, does reduce their likelihood of engaging in violence. Now, that's not, I don't want that to be quoted as a sort of, you know, research finding, but that's sort of what researchers have suggested to me in our conversations.
I'm also wondering if you've noticed any changes in discourse around the use of guns in the last few months, with regards to food shortages, People are saying they have to protect themselves. Even a lawmaker in Michigan felt the need to protect herself from armed protesters. Even the people who allegedly killed Ahmaud Arbery, which is a name that has been on the tips of a lot of people's tongues in the last week or so, they say they were protecting themselves. They thought that Ahmaud was running around the neighborhood trying to steal things. So is that something that you've seen come back on kind of all sides of this issue? Is people feeling the need to be vigilant and armed in order to prevent something bad that might still be coming with this coronavirus?
Yeah, so I think that I think there's like a clear racial divide in that feeling that you're talking about. I've done reporting on surges in gun sales across the country. And you know, this started sort of with Asian Americans along the West Coast buying guns in huge numbers. And the reporting that I did sort of found that that was mostly, or at least partially, because people were worried that of racist attacks as a result of the coronavirus. That quickly spread to being just a everyone who is anyone wants to go get a gun because there is this concern of what you're mentioning, like, you know, sort of social unrest. And the reporting that I've seen on that surge in gun buying has spread across, you know, racial divides. That said, I recall a conversation that I had with a professor of mine back in journalism school, who was basically talking about how, and this is a Black professor, and he was basically talking about how there is often an argument that guns, among like gun rights activists, that guns make you safer. And the way that this professor put it to me was like, we've been running that experiment in, you know, predominantly Black neighborhoods in cities for a long time. And I don't think that anybody who lives in those cities would tell you, I think everyone in this city should have a gun. Because what we're finding and what we see, you know, every day is that these having so many guns in these communities leads to more violence. If you had less guns in these communities, you would have less violence. And so I don't think that that feeling of I need to protect myself from this crazy social unrest has shown up prominently in my reporting in cities as it relates to city violence. That seems to be more closely tied to communities that have not had a problem with violence, and that people anticipate the violence will spread to their neighborhood, and so they buy a gun, you know, as a way to protect against that expectation.
So this phenomenon that we're discussing, that shootings have gone up during the coronavirus lockdowns, more or less in cities, it sounds a little bit like President Trump's line that the quote cure is worse than the disease, that stay-at-home measures are intended to stem the spread of the virus are also leading to death in unexpected ways. And on the flip side, Black communities in America, especially in Milwaukee, as you've mentioned, have seen COVID's ravages firsthand. So how is that tension playing out? Wanting to have a kind of a prudent approach to staying at home orders versus keeping people safe? And do some folks want the state to reopen in order to stem gun violence?
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak from my reporting. I have not heard anyone who is anxious to reopen as a result of the coronavirus. There is a very reasonable concern that these like stay at home orders have caused an increase in domestic violence. There was a shooting recently in Milwaukee. It was like a five, I think it was a quintuple homicide. A man killed his family. So I've had sources in Milwaukee who have who work for Foreign for Life, who have sort of said, you know, this is one consequence of the stay-at-home order. At the same time, during the Wisconsin election, I don't think any of those people in my conversations with them were happy that everyone had to rush to the polls and be out and be around people. I think that you're pointing to a tension that is definitely there. It depends on this, on the side of the problem you're looking at. And I'm sure when there is an instance of domestic violence, that prompts everybody to think, if we didn't have to stay at home, maybe this wouldn't have happened. But at the same time, I think that the loss of life as a result of the coronavirus sort of outstrips anything that you'll see from people staying at home and getting involved in violence as a result of staying at home. And I think that there are other, I think it would be unfair to look at that as a binary when there are certainly ways that city governments could intervene and provide more resources and better outreach to make sure that violence doesn't surge during the coronavirus while also making sure that people are staying home and staying safe.
The coronavirus fatalities in America are certainly staggering. So that's an interesting point. Thanks so much for joining us, Champ. Champ Barton is a reporter covering community violence for The Trace. His recent article, which covers Milwaukee, is called When the Shootings Don't Stop. Thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Champ Barton is a reporter for The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom focused on gun issues in America. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Coming up next, how one local distillery has shifted gears to help make hand sanitizer. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's a nationwide shortage of hand sanitizer. Since the coronavirus pandemic began to escalate in March, suppliers have had difficulty keeping up with the intense demand. So, some distilleries, like Twisted Path in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood, have come to the rescue. Brian Sammons is the founder and distiller at Twisted Path. Without the same amount of wholesale demand for his liquors, he says he's been left with more time to make hand sanitizer for groups in need, like hospitals and police departments. Sammons joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers by phone from the distillery.
Since the pandemic began, and since specifically the Safer at Home orders have begun, how has your business been impacted in general?
That's a massive blow. Our tasting room is a big part of our business in terms of just people becoming aware of us and then also just cash flow. It's half the footprint of our distillery. So it went from a good cash flow positive to a big negative. And as far as our staff, most of my staff is tasting room related. So they no longer really have anything to do. And with the unemployment benefit situation coming from the federal government, we laid them off. It was actually better for them, at least temporarily. We do plan on having them all back once we are allowed to reopen. On the wholesale side of selling our spirits, all the bars and restaurants being closed means no sales there, obviously. And then despite people talking about more liquor consumption and more liquor sales at grocery stores and liquor stores, it seems that's mostly gone to bigger, cheaper brands. So a lot of craft distilleries are seeing a drop there too, including mine.
Okay, so the fact that people are drinking at home hasn't had much of an impact.
No, I think, some of our fans, some of the really like people that are familiar with us and love our products and already know about us, if they're drinking more, they'll be buying more of ours. But that is pretty small in comparison to just general people out there that don't really know about us, but might pick us up off the grocery store shelf because they take a look at the bottle and they want to give it a try. And then all the bar and restaurant closings, that greatly outweighs our loyal fans drinking a little more at home.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a huge net negative.
So, you mentioned, of course, you have the tasting room and that most of your staff works there. Have you had to change what you're doing in the distillery itself?
Yeah, I don't know if you count this as lucky or unlucky, but in my distillery, on the production side is mostly just me anyway. So that hasn't been too big of a shift. I had just hired a new full-time production help. And so he's in the wings waiting to come back once we open again. So I had to lay him off and I had one part-time production help, but it was mostly me anyway. So most of my staff was tasting room related. On the wholesale side, it hasn't changed too much, except now, I don't have to make as much because there's just less sales. So I'm just devoting more time to, well, family at home. I've got three little kids, but also new projects, new products and things like that. Just getting things done that, you know, I'd always wanted to have the time for.
I was about to say, you know, you must be making less if there's less of that demand, especially the wholesale demand. And part of what you've done is you've started to make hand sanitizer.
Yeah, that's actually been a huge factor for all of us. I think when this first came, you know, we saw, okay, we're all closing down. You know, downsides are obvious in terms of income and temporary layoffs and things like that. But the upside might be I have more time for those projects. But the hand sanitizer thing popped up. You know, I anticipated a little bit of a run on hand sanitizer right when this first got announced, but then that, you know, the mass scale producers would catch up right away and that the shelves would be filled again 2 weeks later. And that didn't happen at all. So it's been an ongoing massive shortage of hand sanitizer. And, you know, all of us distilleries are getting calls every day seeing if we're producing it. So a lot of us have flipped over, and myself included. I've spent a ton of my time making hand sanitizer, taking high proof alcohol and mixing it with the other two ingredients in the WHO recipe and putting it in little bottles and selling it or donating it to everybody that calls.
Yeah. What is that process like compared to what you normally do? Because in my mind, hand sanitizer and liquor, there wasn't a clear link between the two.
Yeah. Well, so it depends on the hand sanitizer, but the one that's the most effective, the most effective hand sanitizer for this virus are the high percentage alcohol based ones. And we make alcohol and most of our spirits, you know, when you make vodka, it comes off the still at over 190 proof. And that's what you need to make hand sanitizer. So, you know, the fact that we make high proof alcohol is why it intuitively was obvious to jump to us to making hand sanitizer. For a little place like me, however, it is not so much the making the alcohol, because the way I make alcohol, you know, I'm making it from scratch by hand myself from local organic ingredients. When making drinking liquor, that's got a huge upside in the taste and the character of the product. The vodka has a slight butterscotch note and things like that you really appreciate when you're tasting it. If you're making hand sanitizer with it, it doesn't really matter. Clean is clean. And my way of making booze is much less cost efficient. So right away for me, it was a matter of, actually, I'm not going to make the vodka for this. There are these alcohol producers that produce huge quantities of alcohol, very cheap. Tastes terrible, but it'll clean your hands. And so I've been seeking out and finding the high proof alcohol in tanks, getting it here, mixing it up, bottling it, and getting it to people. One of the things that a distillery can do that a lot of other places haven't been able to switch over as quick is bottle things that are flammable. So a lot of bottling lines, like if you had, I mean, I hand bottle, but a lot of bottling lines, you know, they might bottle lotion or something, but they can't put high proof alcohol through that or it'll explode. So that's one of the virtues of a distillery. And we also have all the permits and things necessary to deal with all the paperwork, which is not an insignificant amount of paperwork.
Yeah, I would imagine having to bottle something flammable, there's probably a lot of regulations on that.
There's a lot of regulations, and then just the amount of nonsense with taking, you know, bulk alcohol from one place to another place without paying taxes on it, and then getting the paperwork right to either pay or not pay the taxes on it. Just an enormous, enormous amount of bureaucracy to it. We have to comply with the TTB and the FDA. Their regulations on this whole sanitizer issue have been, and their guidance on it has been constantly shifting and vague. So I kind of thought that the federal government would pretty quickly make this all easier. And I think some individuals in the government have been trying to make it easier, but from the top down, it hasn't been organized. So it's actually ended up making it quite a bit harder because it's constantly changing. You know, to get into a little bit into one of the details is, I thought, you know, in February, I was expecting the fuel ethanol manufacturers, you know, what the gasoline you get at the pump is 10% ethanol. We don't really need it to be going into gas right now. And I expected those ethanol producers that make huge quantities to switch over to sanitizer in February. But nobody from the federal government went to them and told them to do that or helped them to do that. So it's been, you know, distilleries like mine and some others talking to those places, those fuel ethanol plants, and then them figuring out on their own how to get through the federal bureaucracy to switch over. But the good news is that happened just this in the past month. Fuel ethanol places have started to switch over to being able to make hand sanitizer alcohol. And some of those places are huge. So the shortage should be ending. One of the big shortcomings right now, it seems like, is the ability to bottle, like I was saying, with the bottling of flammable liquid, which is why us little distilleries are still doing it. And then also finding little plastic dispenser bottles. Those are in pretty short supply.
Oh, I'm sure. As you kind of mentioned there, the response to this pandemic has been a little ad hoc, with a lot of businesses like yours stepping into this void that they thought, you know, or we thought would be filled by a lot of other bigger corporations. When it comes to people who are reaching out to you for hand sanitizer, who are some of these people? Who are some of these organizations where you might have thought they would have gotten it from somewhere else?
Oh, I mean, the many places like the State Department of Corrections needing sanitizer for all the prisons in the state, the post office for all the, you know, post offices, and that's obviously federal government, police departments from all over, fire departments from all over. I had the Army. I think the most surprising would be an Army Medical Corps unit contacted me, the supply officer did, and said, "We can't find hand sanitizer." I was so shocked. I said, I mean, you know, I thought that it was out there, but the federal government was sort of organizing where it goes and prioritizing. So my reaction was, if the Army Medical Corps doesn't have it, who does? And he didn't know. So he came to me. I mean, it's a fairly small unit, so I was able to supply them with what they need. And we actually ended up donating that. What we do is we donate it to places that can't pay for it, or, you know, don't have a budget for it, mostly nonprofits like homeless shelters and places like that. And then we charge for the places that can pay for it, like Amazon needed it for their fulfillment center. And then the one offsets the other. That's the idea. But the Army Medical Corps not only didn't have hand sanitizer and had no forecast for when they could get it, despite going to set up tents next to a hospital to treat COVID patients, they couldn't even figure out the bureaucracy to allocate budget to just write me a check or use a credit card to buy it. So we donated hand sanitizer to the Army, which, you know, I'm fine. I'm happy doing that. I think of it more as not really the Army I'm donating it to, because that bureaucracy is ludicrous that they couldn't pay for that. But those guys, you know, those guys in that tent, I'm donating it to those guys, because I don't want them to go without. That's really the idea, is I don't want anybody to go without if they really need it. So it's been even hospitals. We've been contacted by hospitals that I thought would have been at the very top of the list of people to get it if somebody was organizing that. But then now it's been, you know, it's all the way down to just individual companies and businesses looking around for it. Trucking companies, construction companies, grocery store chains, people that are anticipating opening and are trying to get ready for that. You know, haircutting places, shopping malls, stuff like that. They've all been reaching out. Everybody's been having a hard time finding it. But so a lot of us have been doing pretty much our own triage, deciding who gets it, particularly early on. Now we're starting to catch up where we've got enough for pretty much anybody that asks. But early on, it was, you know, having to prioritize nursing homes, homeless shelters, hospitals, fire department, police department, that kind of thing, before we get to, you know, the food canning place would be next, you know, and haircut places might not get it yet. So yeah, it's been everybody from all levels of government agencies and then private sector. And like I said, Amazon was one of them, you know, at the fulfillment center, which was surprising me. If Amazon can't get it, I'm not sure who could.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, these are kinds of decisions that I can't imagine you thought you would be making going into the distillery business.
No, I mean, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, it was also just overwhelming volume. So it had me, now things have finally slowed down a little bit for me. I've just calmed down a little. But that first month or so when this was really unfolding, it was kind of intense because, I had to let go of the whole staff and it's just me. And then the phone calls and emails constantly about hand sanitizer, trying to put together a spreadsheet and prioritize triage, like I said, while also trying to find the ingredients, trying to actually make the stuff, actually bottle the stuff and label it and sell it and get it out the door. You know, doing all that myself was a bit nuts. It almost reminded me of like sort of a wartime scenario. I was at the CIA in the aftermath of 9/11 on the Bin Laden team. So it kind of reminded me slightly of that, where just running around like crazy and getting things done as fast as possible and in a bit of a triage mode. But I didn't expect that in the distillery business. I expected to be mostly relaxed and fun, but, you know, got to do what you got to do. And a lot of us have stepped up. And that's one of the things that's really heartening is pretty much everybody that's been, you know, been contacted, these small distilleries across the state, we're all stepping up. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think we're all just really happy that we can do something to help.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure, especially as so many have businesses that are struggling.
Yeah, I mean, nationally, you know, there's a national poll. I've heard this about breweries, small breweries and small distilleries, that they expect if we're closed through June or so, that up to 60% could go under. I don't think it's going to be that bad, but it gives you a sense of the possible peril that a lot of us small businesses are in. And then obviously, you know, I think you're referring to is obviously not just us, but almost all small businesses are in real trouble, and some big businesses could be in real trouble here. But yeah, we're all just doing what we can.
Yeah. Well, Brian Sammons, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me today and for sharing what you're doing right now.
Yeah, thank you.
Brian Sammons is the owner and distiller at Twisted Path Distillery in Bayview. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.